Two government reports about how it's going in Iraq came out within minutes of each other last week. One said things are peachy and everything's going well. The other said, no way, the picture is very bleak. Yeah, we were confused too, so we're bringing out the big guns to explain everything. Then, we'll check out the explosive new article that says not only are we already in a covert war with Iran, the only people who don't know about it, yeah, are us. Well, we know now. Also, we're sorry, but we just can't make your 4th of July barbecue this year. Frankly, we can't afford the gas or the mayonnaise. See you at Thanksgiving. And finally, we like beer. No, I mean it, we really like beer. Check out which president we're toasting with a frosty cold one and why. You're listening to The Progressive Beat with your hosts, Christy Harvey and John Neuroer. Stick around for the next 60 minutes. We can't make you hotter, but we can make you smarter. And face it, here in Washington, D.C., knowledge is power, and power is sexy. Okay, first off, we've got a couple of really big stories to go over. Hey, John.
Hey, Christy. How are you?
I'm okay. Did you read the explosive new article that was in The New Yorker?
I did. Seymour Hersh.
Seymour Hersh just came out, and this thing is crazy. Basically, it said that late last year, Congress agreed to let President Bush have a major escalation of covert operations against Iran, basically start a secret war against Iran, and gave him $400 million for
it. And it was signed off by leading Democrats in the Intelligence Committee.
The group of eight.
Both houses. Right.
Exactly. The four leading Democrats and the four leading Republicans in Congress said, sure, go ahead. Yeah. Fine. So this program basically is trying to, A, destabilize the country's religious leadership,
right.
B, gather intel, and C, round up dissidents / people we don't like and take them to our secret prisons in Iraq, around the world, and Guantanamo.
It's very 1980s-esque. It reminds me a lot of the kinds of stuff that we were doing while we were arming the Taliban against the Soviet Union.
Right.
And you know, being in bed with Saddam Hussein against Iran, and it's exactly the same kind of thing that we're pulling right now.
Well, and not only that, I love how it's supposedly a covert operation,
right?
But Congress knew about it. I'm pretty sure the Iranians know about it.
Exactly.
Basically, the only people who don't know about it are you and me and basically the rest of America.
Well, and the other problem is that there's a New York Times piece last week that talked about this, but that, you know, a lot of the justification that the administration is using is that Iran is doing a lot of their dirty work in Iraq right now, that they
right.
are killing Americans in Iraq. And the New York Times article said, well, you know, intelligence experts still say that that's up in the air. It's unclear whether or not that's actually going on.
Well, we saw a lot of, according to this New Yorker piece, all of this really came to a head last October through December when President Bush really tried to push this through Congress.
Right.
And you remember, that's when the National Intelligence Estimate came out saying, yeah, here's the thing, guys. There's not really a big push for Iran to go nuclear. They're not the big threat. But at the time, and we thought this, you and I actually talked about this, we
right.
thought it was pretty crazy because out of nowhere, the president, the vice president, and all of his minions were out trying to really get people freaked out about Iran. If you remember October
right.
2007, out of nowhere, President Bush gives this speech about Iran and he starts using scary terminology like World War III.
So I've told people that if you're interested in avoiding World War III, it seems like you ought to be interested in preventing them from having the knowledge necessary to make a nuclear weapon.
You can't just drop the WW3 like that.
No, it's like when he used to talk about the mushroom cloud before he went into Iraq. It makes no sense unless you realize what he was doing, which was trying to freak people out so that they would put pressure on their Congress members to do something.
Exactly.
And then pressure, this would put a little bit of pressure on them to go along with what he was talking about.
And not only that, but you talk about the NIE that came out late last year. How much did we hear about that? Not a whole lot. I mean, they put the kibosh on that very quickly and also dismissed these findings. Ironically enough, it was an NIE about Iraq that they cherry-picked intelligence from in early 2003 to justify going to war in Iraq.
Right. And so this looks very, very similar in a really scary and bad way to pre Iraq 2002, and it looks like we're doing some of the same stuff. We even had, do you remember crazy mustachioed John Bolton?
He was our love that stash.
He was our ambassador to the UN and a big neocon, and he was out trying to rattle the sabers and get people really freaked out all around the same time, too. He actually said that we almost have to, for the good of the country, it would be stupid not to bomb Iran.
So I think this is a case where the use of military force against a training camp or to show the Iranians we're simply not going to tolerate this is really the most prudent thing to do. And then the ball would be in Iran's court to draw the appropriate lesson.
Okay, we're going to bomb you and then take that as you will, right?
Right, right. It's up to you to, you know, get over the bombing.
Oh, maybe it was just fireworks, right?
What? Right,
oh,
right.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, there's another thing that I thought was really interesting in this piece is the White House is relying on these sneaky operatives that are in Iran. They're doing the same thing in places like Pakistan as well.
You mean our sneaky operatives?
Well, who knows? I mean, I think some of them are our sneaky operatives. Some of them
spies?
Are someone else's secret sneaky operatives. But these are the same kinds of problems we had with our intelligence gathering in Iraq in the lead up to war.
You want to talk about curveball again, don't you?
I know that you have this weird kind of like, is it a crush? I don't know if I would say it's a crush. You love the curveball story.
The curveball story is amazing.
It.
It's not a crush. It's an obsession.
Yeah.
But it basically
I think
showed...
you may be in love with curveball, though, in a weird kind of way.
You're right, though. It's we, no, not about the love part, but about the draw that we should say that these two are, you know, two sides of the same coin.
Exactly, because exactly.
We responded to this guy whose nickname was curveball. His nickname was practically Guy Who Lies. And he was in a German prison, and we never talked to him directly. And we just hook, line, and sinker bought everything that he would tell us about Saddam and WMD. And we're doing the same thing with some of this Iran stuff. In that New York Times piece from last week that you talked about, it said, you know, we're just believing anybody on the Iranian streets who comes up to us and says, yeah, we hate you guys in Iraq and are trying to fight against you, even though really there's not a lot of proof that it's as far-reaching as this administration wants us to think.
And if you look at polls, you know, the vast majority of people in the United States do not favor military action. They favor diplomacy. They favor economic sanctions against Iran to try to solve the problems that we're having. But the scary thing is that in Hirsch's article, he says that with what has already been put into place, what operations we already have on the ground, we can't actually halt those operations for at least a year.
Right.
So if Senator Obama, for example, were to win in November, take office in January, it would take at least a year for us to pull back from these secret ops that we're doing in Iran. So
you can't make the avalanche go back up the mountain like that.
Exactly. So even though Senator Obama is running and talking about Iran and using diplomacy, using economic sanctions like the vast majority of American people support, that's, you know, these secret ops are not something we can actually stop.
Well, the good news is we have Larry Korb coming on the show later. Larry is basically a genius when it comes to all of this Iran, Iraq, North Korea. He just sort of knows exactly what's going on in all these hotspots around the world. So we're going to ask him, A, if Cy Hirsch is actually onto something here, because we should state for the record that the Pentagon says that he made this whole thing up and there is no covert operation. Or if there is one, it's not what he said. Or if it is what he said, it's a little bit different. They're not quite sure how they're denying it. But we'll ask Larry about that, and then we'll ask him just exactly how freaked out we should be.
You're listening to The Progressive Beat with Christy and John. Stay tuned. Our second big story this week is that we're all patriotic, but it's tough to be in a celebratory mood when we're all flat broke. Last week, the national average of a gallon of unleaded regular gas was over $4 a gallon. And we have estimates that we may be looking at $5 a gallon by the end of the summer. Beyond that, you have the housing mess, unemployment up, wages are stagnant. All of this makes for a pretty depressing 4th of July, at least for me. I don't know about you, Christy.
So basically, you're just telling everybody how broke we are.
Yeah.
I'm pretty broke.
We're not telling them anything that they don't already know, that's for sure.
Is your financial situation going to change? What are you doing for the 4th? Are you doing what you usually do?
No, well, I think, you know, we're going to have a little bit of a party over at our place. But, you know, one thing we wanted to do...
I'd like to point out that my invitation for said little party has not yet arrived. Okay.
Yeah,
Keep going.
Actually, I couldn't afford a stamp. people are coming over to our apartment. We wanted to go into the city to watch the fireworks.
Right.
And we were all going to hop into cars and drive in. Well, we're... Change of plans. I think we may try to watch from our balcony, you know, which is probably 12 miles away. We'll just listen, I think, because gas is just so expensive and people aren't driving over to the house. We can't carpool. People are taking the bus or the metro over. It's amazing because I can never remember having to actually change my 4th of July plans or any holiday plans.
Because
we're broke, because we can't afford gas. It's ridiculous.
Well, it's funny you say that because, you know, living in Washington, usually my family all comes together and meets me here. And, you know, I've got a sister in South Carolina and we've got friends in Pennsylvania and everybody just sort of gets together. We have big barbecue. We watch the fireworks down in the mall. But this year it's not happening because it just is too expensive to fly. And it's too expensive to drive. And I was feeling sort of bad about it because that sort of sucks that you can't all get together on the 4th. But we're not alone. I was reading the paper yesterday, I believe it was, and AAA came out with their new survey that they do every year where they estimate how many people are traveling. And for the first time this decade, they said that there's going to be a decline in people who are actually traveling on the 4th. There's going to be 550,000 fewer drivers on the road. So I guess for those of us who did save our pennies and are going to be on the highways, that's good news a little bit because the traffic won't be as bad.
Yeah.
But it's kind of bad news because everyone's, you know, holing up in their basements and celebrating lonely with little sparklers instead of having big barbecues.
It really is. It's affecting behavior, and you can see that. I can just tell driving, if you're driving during rush hour around the city. Now, there are certainly less cars on the road right now. It's a good thing, but it's unfortunate,
well,
too.
Did you also hear that it's getting really brutal at car rental counters?
Get out.
Oh, I love this story because they have a certain number of compact fuel-efficient cars and a certain number of SUVs.
And you have to pay for gas when you rent a car.
Right, so everybody wants the more fuel-efficient cars because it can cost you like $40 to $60 more per gallon or tank of gas for an SUV.
Yeah.
But they don't have enough. So what these car dealerships or car rental counters have been doing is they promise everybody that they can have the... cheaper compact cars that'll cost less to drive.
Right.
But they don't have enough. So you get there and they quote unquote upgrade you to an SUV and you're like, but no, I don't want that. But you have to fight now there's all these tips on the internet that I've seen about how you can actually get a car that you can afford to drive and they can't bully you into having to drive, take one of those nasty, you know, Hummers off their hands.
No, sir, I can't afford the free upgrade.
Well, not only is driving so expensive, though, but, you know, even if you've scratched together your pennies and you can drive to your college roommate's house to have a barbecue with her and her husband, you can't afford the burgers and the chips.
Oh, it's ridiculous. How about an increase from last year to this year of 13%? For your mayonnaise.
Oh, man.
How can you have how can you have a barbecue, a cookout, without mayonnaise?
Deviled eggs, potato salad.
Macaroni salad, my favorite. I love macaroni
salad. I hate macaroni salad.
Get out of
it's
here.
Always so greasy. But
not
I like deviled
I
eggs.
It. You know, if you get that invitation in the mail to my picnic, you can come on over and have some good macaroni salad.
Maybe I'll try it, although maybe now I won't be able to come. But everything is up. I read that there was paper plates are up like 14%.
You know what's up a lot is the beef, the meat, hamburger meat.
Oh, yeah.
Up a lot. I mean, it's up a couple dollars, you know, a couple dollars a pound.
Right. And
in some places for the...
Well, and everything... Potato chips up 12%. Hot dogs are up 7%. Hot dogs shouldn't be up 7%.
You know, the only thing I did see, though, that was not up, and so maybe you just have a party with this only.
Yeah.
Hot dog buns.
Hot dog buns are not up.
You could have a buns party.
But you know what else is up? And it's a tragic combination between fuel prices and global warming, and it breaks my heart.
What's that?
Beer.
Oh. And you can't, I mean, why even bother having a 4th of July?
You can't have a 4th of July party without beer. It's not American. And beer is up crazy, crazy amounts depending on what you like to drink. But even, you know, your old standbys, Bud Light, Miller Light, they're all a lot more expensive than they were last year. And part of that is, frankly, global warming. You know, it's killing off some of the, I think it was the hops crop, and
oh,
it's
yeah,
making
yeah,
beer itself
that.
More expensive.
Hops are six times as, you know.
Right.
as much now as they were last year.
Last year, just last year. And that's because of extreme weather. And then also, you know, the reason that all of these other things are up is it costs more to transport them around, to get them from that farm, that cattle farm in Texas,
right,
you know, to our Safeway here in D.C.
You know, high gas prices are one thing, and they're obviously affecting people's behavior. But if you really want to make a real change in America, up beer prices. Really?
That'll get the riots starting.
There will be riots. It will be insane. Well, luckily for us, we can sit here and complain all day, but I think what we really should be doing is talking about why things are so expensive right now. And that is why we are so lucky to have resident smart person on the economy, Amanda Logan, who is the co-author of a new report, Running on Fumes. And the new report takes a look at rising gas prices, but how those rising gas prices are affecting families, especially middle and low income families, on a number of different levels, not just when they fill up their tank. Amanda, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Amanda, your report, Running on Fumes, and the subtitle is Rising Gas Prices Add to the Stain on Families' Already Squeezed Budgets. First of all, it's available at AmericaProgress.org. So one thing that you and your co-author Christian Weller do is you actually come up with a total number for the barbecue this year, the 4th of July picnic, and compare it to that of last year and the year before.
That's right. We took a look at what we thought, you know, the standard American barbecue would cost for 20 family members driving a range of 20 to 40 miles to get there, you know, including all those items that you and Christy talked about, the hamburger buns, the elements for both the macaroni, the pasta salad, and the deviled eggs.
Ooh. Yay!
And
we can agree that we both love the deviled eggs.
Let's just agree that we both like mayonnaise-based products at our picnics.
Who doesn't?
All right.
Okay, sorry. So,
including all of those goodies, combining that with how much the cost of gas has gone up, it looks like if you're going to drive an average of 30 miles and assume that you're going to drive with one other family member, it's going to cost your family a total of $262.34 just to have that basic, you know, buying generics at the grocery store, little barbecue.
And so how does that compare to previous years?
Well, compared to last year, it's up 8.7%, which isn't much, but you still feel 8.7%.
Sure.
And when you compare it to at the end of the last business cycle, so back to 2000, when things were feeling a little bit more hunky-dory, that there's been an increase of 46.8%. So,
which is way beyond what you would expect from inflation.
I'm going to say, I don't think that my income has gone up 46%.
No, that's definitely true. If you're like much of America, we have not seen gains in income or many things except for what we're paying for since that time.
I mean, so gas prices have a lot to do with that, right? I mean, so it's not just that it's more expensive for you to drive the 30 miles when you fill up your tank, but that the food, you know, the other food prices are up because of gas. I mean, so, you know, how much, you know, this all pretty much revolves around this issue of high gas prices.
Yeah, some of the increase in food prices are due to high gas. We didn't really go into that in this particular report, but, you know, there are other things contributing to it. Developing countries needing more food, you know.
Right.
Land being needed to be used for other things this year. But bottom line, it's more expensive to eat and it's more expensive to drive. And these are two things that most people can't really cut out of their consumption. You know, you got to eat. And most people do have to drive to work and don't really have a way of getting around that.
So the numbers that you looked at, there are some groups that are disproportionately affected. Lower income families, minorities. So can you explain sort of logistically why are these low income families, these minority families, for example, disproportionately affected by high gas prices?
Well, it varies by group. If you look at lower income families, we, for example, looked at the bottom or the second bottom 20th percentile in 2006, which is a couple of years ago. They were spending 5.4% of their expenditures on gas versus 3.7% for the wealthiest of Americans. And that's largely due to just, you know, when you're poor, you have a larger share of your income or going towards gasoline.
Right.
If we look at minorities, Hispanics are actually being hit the hardest right now, devoting 5.4% of their expenditures to gas compared to 5% for blacks and just 4.5% for whites on average. And that's largely due to, again, income and where they live. If we start to look at regions and living in the country, or rather in rural areas versus urban areas, that's got mainly to deal with how far they need to drive to get to necessities, like to work, to the doctor. So if you're living in a rural area, in 2006, you were devoting 6.8% of your income to gas versus just 4.4% for urban families. And again, some regions, rather, of the country, you feel it a little bit more, the South being the hardest hit right now. And I should note that all these numbers are about 2006. And think back, 2006 versus 2008, gas prices are way higher now. So the percent of your income going to gas is definitely higher.
That's also a public transportation thing, too, right? You know, I'm from a small town in Delaware, and if you don't drive, you stay home. You don't get to take the subway. There might be a bus, but I don't think I've ever seen it. So is that part of why the people in rural areas are paying more, too?
Yeah, that's definitely got to be a part of why we're seeing those percentages affect people out there, you know. And it's not just to work. It's to the doctor. It's to the grocery store. It's to those basic trips. We've already seen people, like you were talking about, start to alter their behavior, you know, consolidating their trips to the doctor and the post office, or not taking vacations. I mean, last year we were talking about changing how far we were going to go on vacation. And this year, like you've said, we're not talking about vacation. We're talking about having a little barbecue and how much that's going to set us back.
So, I mean, there are some of those things you talk about. You can't cut out trips to the grocery store. You maybe go less often, but you can't cut out trips to the doctor, for example. You know, another thing is that you talk about the difference in percentages that the minority families, for example, are paying for gas, or the rural families or the southern families. In a lot of these cases, these are groups who also, on average, are making less money than an urban, middle to upper class. I mean, obviously, they have more money to expend on gas if they need to. Also, you know, it's sort of a catch-22. You know, they have to cut certain areas, and the price of gas is so high and going up.
And that's true. Historically, when gas has gone up in the past, this isn't the first time that we've been talking about gas rising. This is just the latest. But in the past, you know, people start to cut back on other expenditures, buy smaller cars, postpone the purchase of a new car, cut into their savings and borrow more. And, you know, we're seeing that again. But unfortunately, we're in a situation where America can't really afford to save any less. The first quarter of this year, we were only saving, we had a saving rate of 0.6%. You can't get much lower than that.
No.
And if you look at what average household debt is, we were looking at 132.4% of disposable income going towards debt. So when you're already that much in the hole, it's really hard to put, you know, the gas also on your credit card. You think back to what are other ways you can borrow against your home equity. But as you've been mentioning, we're not exactly in a good housing situation right now with the overall value of homes in the United States going down 2.5% this last quarter. So it's just not a situation where a lot of people can afford to, you know, cut off a little bit of their spending on whatever and then borrow a little bit more to make ends meet. It's also not a new phenomenon. Like, this has been going on for years and years. We've seen wages that have been stagnant for a number of years. At the same time, you know, families are less likely to have health insurance, to have an employer providing their pensions. These are other things that, you know, again, you still have to go to the doctor.
Yeah.
So the cost of healthcare is going up. The cost of energy is going up. The cost of transportation is going up. The cost of college is going up. The cost of housing overall has been going up. Where are we expecting families to get this money
and wages
to come from?
And wages are not.
Yeah, that's really the thing to think about here is that incomes have not been trending upward. And unfortunately, most other things have.
I did read, though, that even though it is disproportionately affecting lower-income Americans, you know, it's not just the worker bees like us who are getting hit by all of this. I read that it's even sort of getting the she people, that housing rentals this summer, vacations in the Hamptons, are down 25%.
Ooh.
So I can't wait to see that Us Weekly, like, Martha Stewart, she's just like us. She can't afford her beach vacation either.
She's walking to the beach instead of taking her SUV. So I think finally the big question, the million-dollar question that it's going to be asked over and over again is, what would help? I mean, what can the federal government do to help? Mm-hmm. What can state government do to help? I mean, what is the answer here?
Well, you know, we've seen a lot of discussion in the news that, yes, better fuel efficiency, more public transportation, conversations about our food and foreign policy really do have a room in this conversation. But they're not all hitting directly at the bottom line problem here. And that is, again, that many American families are hurting because incomes have remained stagnant. They don't have the financial security needed to deal with whatever unexpected expense comes their way. This time, you know, being rising gas and food prices.
Right, right.
So we really need to see a discussion about increasing incomes and whether that's are doing things to create more good jobs that actually provide a living wage and benefits, raising the minimum wage, expanding the earned income tax credit, doing more things to promote and allow union membership, and even expanding unemployment insurance would do some things to help people now and in the next year or so that are hurting the most. It's nice that the Martha Stewart type people are also beginning to see that, yeah, food's expensive, gas is expensive. I might need to change my behavior, but they're not hurting nearly as much as the people we're talking about in lower and middle income America today.
And then in the long run, though, mm-hmm. there are a lot of other questions that we need to be asking about energy independence and clean energy technologies and things like that.
If there is any silver lining in the situation that we're in today, you know, it's really making us focus on the fact that we're probably not in a long-term sustainable, you know, everyone drive an SUV, 30 miles round trip to and from work type of situation. But again, we've got to remember that today, tomorrow, next year, until we can change some huge national policies, lower and middle income Americans are going to hurt as long as they have to pay to eat, to drive, to do whatever else they need to do, and not have the income increasing to sustain their lives.
Amanda, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Amanda. And remember to check out Amanda's report. Absolutely. It's on AmericanProgress.org. She's so smart.
She is so smart.
She is very smart.
Running on Fumes, and Amanda and co-author Christian Weller. AmericanProgress.org is where you can check that out.
You know who's not actually hurting these days, though?
Who's
you know,
that?
Hearing about all of these people who are having to cancel their barbecues and all of this stuff, they're really not hurting down in Houston.
In Houston?
In Houston.
That's interesting. Why is that?
Fabulous piece in Newsweek this week called Houston, We Have No Problems. Love it. And basically, it's talking about how, for example, Maserati sales up 80%.
Just in Houston.
Just in Houston. In Houston, both Chanel and Yves Saint Laurent are expanding their stores at the Galleria. New construction permits for building new homes and malls and cool stuff in Houston, up 30%. Down everywhere else.
Everywhere else, but yeah.
And while the rest of us are, everybody knows someone who's unemployed and having trouble finding a job and you know, really struggling in this current economic market,
yeah.
The Houston region added more than 100,000 jobs last year alone.
Oh, my goodness.
So
that's crazy.
Don't you want to know why?
I mean, I could take a guess, but why?
I think you probably know. Houston, you say Houston,
black
what
gold.
Do you think? Black gold, Texas tea, baby. Houston is the heart of oil country,
yeah.
And all of the money that the rest of us are basically bleeding into our gas tanks is coming out and making some fat pockets in Houston even fatter.
Unreal. That's crazy.
Yeah, it really is. And they basically at this point have so much money that they're struggling to come up with enough things for people in Houston to actually spend it on.
That is just absurd. That's so sad, isn't it?
So I guess we either need to figure out the oil crisis in the country, or we all just start to need to date people down in Houston.
Yeah, for real.
Maybe I need a Texas boyfriend.
A sugar daddy.
A sugar daddy, an oil daddy.
Well, and what's also crazy is that not too far from Houston, there are cities that are hurting. San Antonio, Dallas. I mean,
you can name any city, and that would fill in that blank right there.
Right, but just the juxtaposition and with those cities that aren't far from Houston, it's just so stark. It's crazy.
It is. This is Christy Harvey. You're listening to The Progressive Beat with Christy and John. And when we come back, we have all of the stories that you don't want to miss this week. Now it's time for a little paparazzi politics, as we like to call it, where we bring you the flashiest little stories that are just begging for your attention. Plus, we catch the dirty little secret stories trying to hide their faces from our flashbulbs. No chance. First up today is a story that they really didn't want us to know about. John, do you remember a couple of weeks ago we were all outraged because we found out that Iraq had given a bunch of no-bid contracts to the top American oil companies.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, not all of us were outraged. Not if you were getting the check cut.
The CEO of Exxon, not so outraged.
Not so mad, no.
But the rest of the world was fairly outraged because Iraq's oil ministry basically handed these no-bid contracts, which is not the usual way that they conduct business. Usually you bid, you send in your resume, you give your estimates, and that's how it works.
But it is the usual way that the Bush administration does business.
That is true. Yeah. That is true. So they handed billions of dollars worth of oil contracts to ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, Chevron. And the world was very upset because it looked as if, you know, maybe we'd gone to war for the oil and things like that. But the State Department came forward.
Right.
And the White House spokesperson Dana Perino came forward and said, look, we had nothing to do with this. This was Iraq. Nothing to see here. We weren't involved. They decide they're the ones who really wanted to give no-bid contracts to these oil companies. 2 weeks later, wah, wah, we find out the truth. And it turns out there's a follow-up article this week in the New York Times that says, quote, a group of American advisors led by a small State Department team played an integral part in drawing up contracts between the Iraqi government and the five major Western oil companies.
I am shocked.
Shocked.
They're
just
gambling
shocked.
At Rick's.
Integral part. So they got busted. I mean, face it, we kind of knew this was happening, but now it's in print, in writing. They are stone cold busted.
Yeah, maybe the war will actually pay for itself in oil like we heard from the beginning. It's just that I don't think we're going to see a dime from it. It's going to pay for itself, and it's all going to go to Exxon.
Go to Shell, exactly.
I got one for you that will just shock you and outrage you also.
Okay.
Remember Larry Craig?
Yes.
Larry Craig, like
the toe-tapper.
Toe-tapper. And then remember David Vitter? Senator from Louisiana.
He goes to my church.
He goes to your church.
He goes to my church. Yes, he's the.
We'll leave
senator,
that one alone.
The senator from Louisiana who was caught on the hooker list.
Exactly. Well, these two senators have named themselves as co-sponsors to a new Senate bill, and you'll be very excited to hear what the Senate bill is.
Yes.
The Marriage Protection Amendment. So basically, if passed, the bill would amend the Constitution to declare that marriage shall consist only of the union of a man and a woman. Now, I understand why it's kind of ironic that Larry Craig is signing on to this. But I can understand why David Vitter is signing on to it, because it doesn't necessarily say that it needs to be a monogamous union. You know,
the union of a man, a woman, no his hooker, and the guy in the stall next to you.
No fidelity mentioned in the amendment. So, not a shocker, but you
hypocrisy,
just, you
thy
love
name
it.
Is senator. My God. Maybe this was part of their wives taking them back. Maybe their wives said, you know,
this
you
is
were
the
looking.
Deal.
You were looking for some extracurricular activities in the airport bathroom and with DC hookers. Here's what you, Nate, need to do for me so I stand by you. I want a Marriage Protection Act, buddy, and half.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see how that works
that
out for them.
Actually reminds me, did you see there's this article out today about Bruce Ware? Bruce Ware is this big Southern Baptist, and he gave a sermon from the pulpit of the Denton Bible Church in Denton, Texas, and love this guy. He basically said that guys beat their wives because their wives refused to submit to them as they should, as prescribed in the Bible.
Kind of like how I potty trained my puppy.
Right, right. We're asking for it.
When the wives pee on the carpet, give them a good whack and carry them out to the yard.
Seriously, but he's couching this in religious terms. He said, husbands, because they're sinners, respond to the threat to their authority. And that threat to their authority is women having ideas and being
thinking
by being abusive, which is one of the ways men respond when their authority is challenged.
Wonder if Bruce was a Hillary Clinton fan.
I'm probably going to guess there that that was a no.
I think you're probably right. Speaking of Hillary Clinton fans, maybe. interesting numbers I saw about Fox News, about the cables here. Well, for the longest time now, past couple years, Fox News has had this huge lead in the cable news battle for viewership. But that seems to be trending in a different direction this year.
Really?
Yeah. Apparently, CNN has added 170,000 viewers in the last quarter. And comparing that to Fox, Fox has actually lost about 90,000 average daily viewers in the last quarter through the Democratic primary. And also MSNBC adding 181,000 viewers. They added the most viewers. They're still in third place as far as total viewership. But it may be that Fox News is losing its grip on the maybe the
Hillary outfoxed.
Maybe supporting Hillary Clinton.
You didn't so laugh at my outfoxed joke.
Hurt them, but they're outfoxed. You're so funny.
No, I think that this is actually good news because do you remember that PIPA study that came out a couple of years ago? Mm. It was my favorite study for a while that showed that if you watched Fox News, if you got your news from Fox News, you were more likely to be stupid, basically.
Well,
you were more likely to believe three wrong things about the Iraq war.
Right.
And you were more likely to believe things that were just flat out not true.
I remember one of them specifically was that you were more likely to believe that we found weapons of mass destruction
right.
in Iraq.
And you were more likely to believe that Saddam had been behind the 9/11 bombings.
Right. Which
was
is
another one.
Which
of
is
them.
Actually the scariest one.
So maybe that's what happened here. Maybe people finally said, you know what? It would actually be nice. Like Bill O'Reilly's funny and it's fun to laugh at him, but it would actually be nice to know the truth once in a while.
We shall see. Hopefully that is why.
That would be very nice. I've got a fun one for you.
Yeah.
This is not political, but I love it. So this guy in New Mexico lost his bid to change his name.
Okay,
last
and he wanted
week.
To change it to...
So his current name is Variable. His name is Variable.
His name is Variable.
His name is Variable. And he wanted to change his name to F Censorship. I just censored myself because I don't
right.
feel comfortable swearing on the air. But he wanted his name to be F Censorship and couldn't see why that might be a problem.
What's wrong with that? This is America. Come on.
Wouldn't that be fabulous, though? You're in line at Applebee's and it's like, F Censorship, party of five. Your table is ready. Like, I can just see all the moms earmuffing their little kids.
Well, no, so here's the question. You go to Applebee's, and usually you put either your first name or your last name
uh-huh.
in. So it's either Censorship or
just
F. All right, I have another fun one, too.
Okay, last one. We're about out of time.
And this is not political either.
Okay.
A man put up, and I love to go through eBay just to look at the fun things that people put up on there. So a guy puts up on eBay an auction. He's auctioning off his life, his entire life. So he puts up, this includes his house, his car, his job. It even includes his friends. And I saw an interview with him. He was disappointed. The auction ended, and he only got $384,000 for all of these things. Obviously, he doesn't have... I saw the house. It's a nice house.
Nice
so
house?
Obviously, his friends suck. But, you know, if I put my life up on there, I wonder how much I'd get. Probably enough for a couple six-packs, which is all I need.
That's all you really need. That's all you really need. Speaking of six-packs, one of the best things about working at CAP is that we always have these fantastic events coming through. And last week, there was this great event. It was Elizabeth Edwards, John Edwards' wife, moderated.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had historian Jonathan Alter, who has written a book on FDR. He usually writes for Newsweek.
He's editor of Newsweek.
Editor
yeah.
of Newsweek. But he's also a part-time historian and a real expert on Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
And he told this fascinating story about how FDR kind of got people on his side. It was right after, you know, the effects of the Depression were still being felt, and he wanted people to start putting their money back in the system and put their money back in the banks. And he had a novel way of doing that. Beer. Listen up.
Happy days are here again.
Yeah, I mean, Roosevelt said almost nothing in the 32 campaign of any consequence. And so almost everything that he did, they were inventing on the fly. But there were little sweeteners in there, and something that I didn't know about until I started researching the book. Right after his first fireside chat, where with his brilliant communication skills, he got people to take their money out from under the mattress and redeposit it in banks as they opened. He still didn't think that was enough, so he went back to the office and he said to his aides, "I think it's time for a little liquid refreshment. Beer!" And they speeded a bill through to legalize 3-2 beer, which under the Volstead Act they could do without repealing the constitutional amendment, which they did at the end of 1933. And so You know, he knew, and then a beer truck pulled up at the White House, you know, literally the next day after the bill passed, and they, this one's for you, Mr. President, you know, and he had the first beer, and that was all really great, and I interviewed people in their 90s who remembered this. It really lifted their...
popular?
And that,
hard to imagine.
You know, and there are things like this, this that could be done now, sort of, you know, sweeteners for all kinds of different legislation.
I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
And now for something a little more serious, though. You may wish you had a beer when you hear about the state of the world today. Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, every day it seems like there's a completely new story of international upheaval, and frankly, it makes our heads spin a little bit. But when we want to make sense of the world, there's one man we know we can call. Center for American Progress Senior Fellow and resident smart guy, Larry Korb. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Christy. How are you?
I'm okay. Let's start with Iraq. Namely, last week's dueling reports. I found these to be pretty confusing. First, the Pentagon released a 74-page report that said everything's going pretty well, it's pretty peachy. But something like 10 minutes later, the GAO released a report saying, whoa, hold on there, the Pentagon is cherry-picking information, and in reality, pretty major goals remain unmet, and the situation's fairly bleak. Which report do I believe, or is it a combination of both? Walk me through these.
Well, I think you really got to believe the GAO, the Government Accountability Report, because those are your outside auditors. Obviously, the Pentagon, General Petraeus, they have a vested interest in making the situation look as good as they can, whereas GAO is the unbiased, informal arbiter. And the key thing that they said was that the whole purpose of the surge and our military involvement is to get the Iraqis to make political progress,
right.
And they're not. I mean, for example, one of the things I found most interesting was the Pentagon said, gee, they're spending a lot more money than this year. They're getting it out to the provinces. GAO said, no, they're not. What you're doing is the dollar declined, the Iraqi currency went up. That's the difference.
Right, right. So it's that. What's that old adage that figures don't lie, but liars can figure?
That's basically it. And I think the key thing is the Iraqis have not made the political progress that young Americans have been fighting and dying for, you know, over 5 years.
Right. You have been key in sort of putting together a plan for redeployment, basically how to win slash fix the situation in Iraq and bring our soldiers home. Walk me through that a little bit. Is that still a viable plan with the way the war looks right now?
Well, I think so, because I think until you set a definite date for withdrawal, the Iraqi government will not take the hard steps that are necessary to unify the country, nor will the countries in the region take responsibility for Iraq, because they're all involved now, but not in a constructive way. But if they knew we were leaving, they know that they would have to live with the consequences as well. And so
Right. What
we've argued here at the center, going back to 2005, you don't need a military surge, you need a diplomatic surge.
Right. And that really does line up a little bit with that GAO report we were just talking about. They were saying something very similar, that it's got to be diplomacy, not just guns.
That's correct.
Well, speaking of wars, how about the other war, Afghanistan? Things seem to be pretty rocky there right now. I read that for the first time, more U.S. and NATO soldiers were killed in Afghanistan than were killed in Iraq last month. What's the situation on the ground over there?
Well, what's happened is we basically diverted our attention from Afghanistan before the job was done, and we don't have enough troops there to provide security for the people in Afghanistan, and the situation continues to deteriorate. Again, we addressed this last fall here at the center. My colleague Carolyn Wadhams and I put out a report called The Forgotten Front. They mm-hmm. forgot about it. Now, with the violence being what it is, people are beginning to pay attention to it. Our problem is we're so bogged down with so many troops in Iraq, we can't send the forces we need to Afghanistan. General McNeil, the commander just leaving, said, well, I need 40,000 more troops.
Oh, man.
The best we could send was 3,200.
Right. That's a scary number. I saw that Dick Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State from 01 to 05, actually was talking about the Afghanistan strategy recently and said, we're just kind of drifting.
Well, I think Rich Armitage put it very well. And Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, in Iraq we do what we must, in Afghanistan we do what we can.
Right.
Well, what we can do is not enough.
Well, obviously, there was also a New York Times piece yesterday that said that al-Qaeda is almost fully reconstituted in that Pakistan border region. And please try and walk me off the ledge on this one, because this freaked me out. He said that they're actually training in camps to attack Western targets again. I thought that's what we went into Afghanistan in 01 to stop.
Well, we did. And what happened is we didn't finish the job. That has allowed them to reconstitute themselves along the border. And because of the policy the Bush administration had toward General Musharraf, they basically ignored that for too long a time. We've got a new government in Pakistan now, and they're not willing to take the steps either.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the worst of all possible worlds. We're focused on Iraq, where al-Qaeda was until we went in there. Al-Qaeda Central, if you will, has reconstituted itself along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, not only getting ready to attack targets all over the world, but raising havoc in Afghanistan as well.
Larry, we wanted to ask you about something we talked about earlier, Seymour Hersh's New Yorker piece from this week about Iran. First of all, these covert operations that he talks about sounds to us a lot like the run-up to the war in Iraq. Now, is that a fair comparison?
Well, I think it's fair in the sense that we're getting involved in something without the American people really realizing the full consequences. Now, according to Cy Hersh's article, they did notify the intelligence communities and you know, with a presidential finding, and hopefully they said something about it. The problem is it doesn't look like they did. And again, you have to be very careful, because while we might call it covert ops, the people there know exactly what's
Absolutely.
Going on, and we're going to be blamed for it. And then pretty soon, you know, we'll be bogged in to another conflict. And we have trouble handling two right now.
Yeah, I mean, on a more pragmatic level, I mean, my next question was, can we really afford, I mean, as far as the state of our military, I know you've done a lot of work on this in the last couple of years. Can we really afford wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and then Iran as well?
Oh, we can't do it unless you want to go to a draft. I mean, we simply don't have enough troops to be able to do that. And even Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, when asked, he said, we're at war with two Muslim countries, and we don't want to start a war with a third. That's why you have to be very careful. It's very easy to start a war. The real problem is stopping it.
Well, and what do you think the consequences of having a conversation, a national dialogue about a draft would be?
Well, I think the American people then would put pressure on their representatives not to begin engagements that are not in our national interest. I mean, the American people were told that the war in Iraq would be cost no more than $50 billion. It would be over in 3 months. And so, and they also told that there were weapons of mass destruction and ties to al-Qaeda. Those things turned out not to be true, and the costs were much larger. Had you told the American people over 4,000 dead, $1 trillion in expenditures, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis dead, so Iraq could have an election, you'd have been laughed out of the ballpark.
Oh, absolutely. And that's even just the tip of the iceberg. The Pentagon last week said that they even put a number on how much it would take to repair the damage we've done to the military. I think they said it would cost about $100 billion. That's with a B, $100 billion, to repair and replace worn-out equipment. Is this accurate? And if so, where do we get that kind of dough?
Well, it is accurate. And again, I don't want to push our own products too much, but we pointed this out. We did two studies in 2006 called, you know, the Army equipment after Iraq and Marine Corps equipment after Iraq. And that's a figure that we came up with at the time. The problem will be that when you get out of Iraq, hopefully soon, there'll be no more supplementals. This will have to come out of the regular defense budget, and it'll compete with buying new equipment as well as expanding the size of the Army and the Marine Corps. And if you look at the Bush administration projections for defense over the next 5 years, there's simply not enough money to do all three of those.
So what happens if we can't? What happens if we don't do all three of those?
Well, basically, then you're going to have to suffer. If you don't reset the Army and the Marine Corps, they're not going to be able to carry out their missions. If you don't modernize the Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force, And the next time you go into a conflict, you're not going to have the top-of-the-line equipment. And if you don't expand your ground forces, you're not going to be able to relieve the strain on the, particularly the soldiers and the Marines.
Okay, finally, Larry, most people know you as a heavy hitter on national security, author of How to Redeploy, former Assistant Secretary of Defense. But we know the real Larry, and we know your true calling, which is monster Yankees fan. So now just a totally random question. Yankees 2008, any World Series hopes?
I think so. I think they always do better in the second half of the season. And the fact that they're still in it, having lost 60% of their starting pitchers, I think they're doing pretty well.
Okay. Well, I'm going to hold you to that one, although go Nationals. All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. You've been listening to Larry Korb on the Progressive Beat with John and Christy.
You know, I don't really like to upset Larry Korb. But just like when the Dallas Cowboys lose, it makes me so happy when the Yankees lose.
Actively happy.
Actively elated.
It's actually how I feel when the Terps lose.
I'm
not a University of Maryland fan, so
ooh.
I know how you feel there. You know what makes me happy?
What's that?
Beer. Do you realize how much we've talked about beer in this show? I'm a little embarrassed about it.
Hi, we're Christy and John, and we are... Hi, Christy.
Hi. What I was going to say, what made me happy was this new University of Michigan study that came out about happiness.
Okay.
You're going to love this. It turns out that around the world, people are just happier nowadays.
Huh.
They, I guess, do this survey every year since 1981.
Okay.
And assess the different levels of happiness in 26 different countries. And the happiest country in the whole world, I guess the Disneyland of the world, is Denmark. They're very happy in Denmark.
Okay.
Saddest, that the unhappiest is, probably no surprise, it's poor Zimbabwe.
Yeah, naturally.
Not so happy in Zimbabwe.
Not right now, no.
Guess how happy
we are.
Okay,
so where are we? Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
We're 16th.
16th, not bad.
Not bad. You know, it could be a lot worse, but there are 15 countries happier than we are, and 10 countries not quite as happy as we are.
Okay, so stuck in the middle. You know why I think people are happier now, though?
Oh, dear.
Than they were?
Beer?
Well, besides beer, but I think that's stayed the same since the 1980s.
Right.
But if you look at hairdos and clothing apparel.
Okay.
Definitely an improvement now on the early 80s when they started doing this.
That is very true, although the researchers at the University of Michigan have their own theories.
Oh, okay.
They don't really,
this wasn't it?
They don't get into neon versus no neon, but they do say that they think it's because of increased democratization and social tolerance. So as people have become more tolerant in a society, the happier that society has gotten.
I think in their further research section, they definitely should have noted that further research should be done on hairdos and wind pants.
I know, but hairdos and breakdance pants were actually, that sadness was always offset by actual breakdancing. Actual breakdancing can make you pretty happy.
Touche, Christy, touche.
The countries that had the most steeply rising happiness levels were India, Ireland, Mexico, Puerto Rico, and South Korea.
Okay.
They're getting happiest fastest.
Okay.
And the downers, the Debbie Downers, all seem to be in Austria, Belgium, and the UK.
And wah, ironically wah. Enough, if you want to attribute this to beer at all, Austria, Belgium, UK, huge drinking countries.
Oh, so maybe you're on to something.
Alcohol
there.
Is a depressant.
And that's the show. Thanks for listening to The Progressive Beat with Christy Harvey and John Newark, broadcast, as always, from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. And we told you we'd bring you from zero to smart in 60 minutes.
And remember, in D.C., smart is hot.